couldn't make the talk, to give a talk tonight, and I always ask people to investigate whether there's any dukkha, because their disappointment that the person who was supposed to give a talk isn't here. And that's particularly appropriate tonight, since basically I'm asking the question, does your desire cause suffering? So if your desire to have a particular speaker is disappointed, then it creates some sort of stress or dissatisfaction, right? And really, a way to look at this practice is, this word dukkha, the Pali word dukkha, that the first noble or ennobling truth is often translated as suffering, but it's a very subtle word. Stress, dissatisfaction. I mean, ultimately, it really refers to the sense of someone outside the experience, someone having an experience. That's when the Buddha says he's talking about the end of dukkha. He's really talking about the sense of a me that this all is happening to. The level of dukkha is really kind of proportional to the difference between what's actually happening and what we'd like to be happening. Sort of a pointer to desire. So if you're having great difficulty, you might just really, just pose this question, what kind of desire do you have? How do you want things to be that's different from how they actually are? Because that's the only time that you can be free is right now. And so in some sense, we talk about acceptance or allowing, but it's not just a technique. It's actually a direct pointer to freedom, to find a way to open up to what's here right now. This topic of desire is just so big, and I can only touch on it tonight, so hopefully the particular issues that are relevant to you, we can flesh out some in the discussion tonight. But the Buddha said some really kind of remarkable things about desire. As I kind of think about what he said, it sort of knocks my socks off. And I think people can take different attitudes to what he said. For me, it's like, wow, I want to know what he's talking about. And for other people, like, I'll never get there. What is this craziness? And I think the thing is to really start where you are, as Pema Chodron said. For some people right now, the freedom is just not getting upset when someone blows a horn at you or cuts you off. Ajahn Suchito was in Lexington giving a talk last week, and some guy said, I came here to practice, and I thought, I'll never be awakened. But, then I started seeing, if some guy cuts me off and I get angry, it doesn't help me any. And he said, he told a story about some guy cutting him off. And, he said, I just didn't react. I just let the guy go. And he said, guy probably thinks I'm really kind and compassionate. But, I'm just taking care of myself. And there's a big element of truth in that, really. If we just look at what causes some sense of stress and dissatisfaction for ourselves and really take care of that, it's really in the best interest of everyone. So what are the kind of phenomenal things that the Buddha said? He said, all phenomena is rooted in desire. Everything you see, think, do, or experience comes from desire. Either consciously or unconsciously, desire keeps defining who we are. Desire actually creates this sense of us in this matrix of space-time. Actually, I'm not talking about what the physical universe is. I'll leave that to physicists. But experientially, this desire creates a sense of time. It creates a sense of someone separate from the experience. It creates a sense of space. It creates all this form that we see. I mean, it's really like a core driver of this whole world that we perceive. Ajahn Tanissaro, who translates a lot of the Pali text, into English, said that all the four noble or ennobling truths are about desire. So it's an important concept to investigate, and I think it's a very confusing issue. You know, we say, you know, sometimes it's, people say, well, desire is the cause of dukkha. Well, what desires, what kind of desires do I do, you know, what would I do if I didn't have desire? So I want to start by reading the second noble truth and just talking about it a little bit. And this is Ajahn Suchito's translation of it. There is a noble truth concerning the arising of dukkha. Now, as I said, dukkha is usually translated as suffering. I think we all kind of have some sense of suffering. It's just old age, sickness, death, loss of loved ones. You know, pretty easy to understand what that is. There's also the dukkha of everything is contingent. Everything, all conditioned things are impermanent. So no matter how we line things up, they change. But and again, there's this very fine notion of dukkha, someone outside of experience. So dukkha arises of craving, a thirst for more that's bound up with relish and passion and is always running now here, now there. That is a thirst for sensuality, a thirst to be something, and a thirst not to be something. So, you know, the word is, I mean, what we're talking about here, this particular translation uses craving and thirst, not desire. And the Pali word is used in the second noble truth is tanha. And it literally means thirst, an unquenchable thirst. So that's what he's talking about as, I would call it the palpable cause of desire. There's a whole bunch of things contribute to it. So ignorance, desire, you know, it's not the only cause. And one way of looking at it is desire is the cause of ignorance and ignorance is the cause of desire. And so it's kind of like a simultaneous equation. How do you solve it? Because you can't let it go of desire if you're ignorant, and you can't see the get through ignorance if you have desire. So maybe that's why awakening is kind of an accident. Okay. So we're talking about three kinds of thirst here. We're talking about thirst for sense experiences, you know, just the five senses we all have. We want to have pleasant sense experiences. We want to get rid of unpleasant sense experiences. I imagine some people sat here tonight and had pains in knee, had back pains, might felt tired. We want to get rid of all those unpleasant sense experiences, and we like to have a nice samadhi and sense of ease and peace. That's one kind of desire. And the sense experience also includes the mind. In Buddhism, it's just, you know, it's just viewed as a sense. So we like to have pleasant thoughts, pleasant emotions, get rid of the unpleasant thoughts, unpleasant emotions. So there's a desire for the thirst for sensuality, the thirst to be something, you know, to be a bright person, a kind person, a compassionate person, attractive person, successful person, anything solid. We have some idea we're going to be this. That's a cause of dukkha. Why is it a cause of dukkha? Well, there's a lot of effort to get there, and then it isn't what you think it is anyway, and it changes. Okay. And finally, the thirst for non-existence. It's like when all this frustration with sense experiences, with trying to be something, just gets frustrated. It's like there's a desire not to be here at all. So tanha is a reflex. It's not something we decide to do. It's just we react that way. You sit here with a pain in the knee, the mind says doesn't like it, wants to get rid of it, moves away from it. It sees someone that's attractive and it moves toward it. It's not kind of a nice thought out, you know, I want to do this because of some reason type sort of thing. And it's going on all the time. And we don't realize it because it's going on all the time. Every moment of contact, and contact is just a sense door, such as you know, maybe a felt sense or seeing something, and a sense object, what is seen, every time that happens, sense door contacts a sense object, there's a knowing of it, what arises is a feeling tone. It's just pleasant or unpleasant, neutral, doesn't have much charge, and a perception, which is a learned way of seeing things. So, you know, we might see a particular person and we kind of been conditioned that that person is frightening, and there's an unpleasant feeling arises, and then there's a whole stream of thoughts and emotions that arise out of that. And it's going on all the time. We don't think of it as anything could be any other way. Now, there's a different kind of so desire in English is kind of, you know, it's got a lot of meanings to it. So there's another word in Pali called chanda, which is more neutral than tanha. Tanha is driven by, supposedly, the words that are used are greed, hatred, and delusion. And there's a lot of variance, a lot of a continuum around, well, greed, you know, it might be just wanting a little bit of a cup of tea, or it might be you need to have $39 billion to feel satisfied. And hatred can be a mild aversion to some unpleasant experience, like I don't want to, I wanted it to be sunny and warm today. Okay. But chanda is a neutral term. And it depends upon the motivation behind chanda. If it's a motivation from a place of kindness and compassion, a motivation to awaken, it's a motivation to do something. It's really not a pathology, it's a yes, a commitment to becoming free. So you can kind of think of these as skillful and unskillful desires, if you want. Skills that lead to peace and skills that lead to suffering. And it, you know, it's an interesting investigation to really explore that for yourself. You know, when we have a particular, I'll use the word desire now, is it skillful or unskillful? Are thoughts skillful? Do they lead to peace or do they lead to suffering? So if someone insults us and then we spin a whole story about, I can't believe it, and we keep on feeding it, probably not very skillful. So I want to just give some examples of how, I guess I'll use the word desire tonight, but is how desire causes suffering, how to work with it. About over 10 years ago, I was on a three-month retreat in England, and it's a personal retreat, so I had a lot of freedom about what I do with my time. And at breakfast, if you didn't get there first in line, most of the fruit was gone. Sometimes all the fruit was gone. And so I found myself kind of hovering around the dining hall when it got close to breakfast time. And then, you know, the realization came, you know, I'm putting a lot of effort into getting this fruit. And, you know, it doesn't really matter that much. It just really isn't that important. And that's actually kind of somehow the way to work with desires, one way. The Buddha talks about gratification, danger, and escape. So the gratification is I get in line, I get the fruit, you know, feels good. The danger is I'm relying on it. It's not that it's a problem to have pleasant experiences. In fact, that's really a large part of practice is doing that. This chanda of developing kindness and compassion and learning to sit and really unify the mind, body, heart, the intention of that is really to develop a sense of uplift. And actually, when we do that, there's less need for other things. When we feel good about ourselves and we calm our minds, we're not stressed out, we don't need something else to make us feel okay. So it isn't, the gratification is not the problem. The problem is, the danger is that we rely on it we have to have it to feel okay. And the escape is to see that, to see the danger of always wanting pleasant sense experiences, always wanting good emotions, wanting people to treat us a certain way, wanting spring to be warm and sunny. You know, it's fine to enjoy that. It's just that when we're oriented around that, we create stress because it just doesn't line up all the time. You know, what happens when you get sick? You know, if you insist on your body feeling good, it's a pretty miserable experience. But if you can learn to open to it, there's a peace there. So much of our practice is learning to really just open to whatever is there. And that's not easy. It takes a skill to do so. And you know, the other thing about gratification is it's impermanent. And so when it says we're running here and running there, it's because, you know, we kind of grab onto something, feels good for a little bit. You know, maybe we're tired, we have a cup of coffee, and it kind of lifts us up. But then after a while, you're tired again. And, you know, after a while, you know, you're sort of type hyper world because you've pumped so many coffee into yourself. And I guess I remember when early in my practice and people said, well, you know, desire is a problem because everything's impermanent. And I said, well, my thought, I don't know if I had the guts to say it to a teacher, but I certainly thought that, well, maybe it's impermanent, but I want as much of the good stuff as I can get, right? And so I think it's really important to kind of see that trying to get it creates some form of stress. And when we see it clearly, then we you know, the renunciation takes place automatically. It's not like we're trying to will not doing this anymore. We see the suffering it generates, and then it's really not even letting go. It's just letting it be, seeing with wisdom what's happening, and the letting go just happens. There's a freedom from that. And the result of kind of seeing how these things that we feel like we want so much causes some sort of stress is we become less enchanted with them. We don't need them so much. So I kind of gave up the fruits, right? Or when I was on a retreat for about 6 weeks and at the Forest Refuge just working with impermanence. And, you know, I have a meal, maybe a really good meal. Something was particularly good, and I think, oh, maybe just to get a little bit more of that. And, you know, if I did, how long did the satisfaction from that last? Not very long. And if I didn't, you know, a few minutes later, I've forgotten about it. I'm sort of not running around thinking, oh, boy, if I'd had that extra bite, I'd be happy forever. Okay. Now, these are fairly light aspects of stress and dissatisfaction. But, you know, sometimes these desires result in addiction, alcoholism, drugs, compulsive eating, gambling, sexual desires that lead to very unwise behavior. And I've been thinking about giving a talk on desire for about 6 or 7 years just so I could read this one particular thing to you tonight. And it's from the novel Anna Karenina, and I don't know how many people are familiar with that, but in Anna Karenina, there's a handsome Russian officer named Count Vronsky, and he becomes infatuated with Anna Karenina. And Anna Karenina is married, has a couple of kids, and her husband's a very upright guy, not exactly a sensitive guy, not New Age sensitive. He sort of has no idea how to relate to people, but, you know, he has good ethics and things. So she's trying to really be good, you know. He keeps chasing her from one city to another, trying to seduce her, and she puts him off. But finally, she succumbs, and it leads to disastrous results for her. And I just, that Tolstoy knew something. I mean, just, I just want to read this to you. It's really amazing. Vronsky, meanwhile, despite the full realization of what he had desired for so long, was not fully happy. So he got her, right? You know, he's in this relationship with her. And he soon felt that the realization of his desire had given him only a grain of the mountain of happiness he had expected. Only a grain of the mountain of happiness he had expected. It showed him the eternal error people make in imagining that happiness is the realization of their desires. So maybe he, maybe Tolstoy was a Buddhist, I don't know. he soon felt arise in his soul a desire for desires and anguish independently of his will. He began to grasp at every fleeting caprice, taking it for a desire and a goal. As a hungry animal seizes upon every object it comes across, hoping to find food in it, so Vronsky unconsciously seized upon, and it goes through a long list of politics, etc., that he tried to seize upon. And underlying all this drive and desire to get things is this sense of inadequacy, of being incomplete and needing to be filled up by something. And, you know, again, back to this whole question about desire. Remember, you know, early in a retreat, maybe second, third year, maybe second year of my practice, maybe first year, I don't know. Some guy said, well, he says, when I asked the question, well, what are we supposed to do with all these desires? The answer I got was, well, it's pretty hard to do anything unless you have something else. And I just didn't find that very helpful because I didn't know what something else was, right? And you know, if we don't think there's anything else, if we don't find some internal peace, then, yeah, maybe we go around chasing a lot of things because they fill us up for a little while. You know, I love the expression, hoping to find food. Eckhart Tolle talks about the pain body. It's like this part of us that just, it's going to exist somehow, and it just needs to find something to feed on. It doesn't matter if it makes us perfectly miserable. It gives us a sense of we're here. So the pain body might, you know, find you're in some relationship, and you know, maybe it's a pretty good relationship, but you find a part of the relationship that's not so good. And then you sort of focus on that. You feed on it. And then the mind gets tired of that because it's just not satisfying anymore. So find something else to feed on. It's just always running around here and there. Ajahn Suchito uses, I think, another nice little metaphor. He calls it grab and drop. So we keep reaching out for something and we hope it's going to satisfy us. And one of two things happens. You know, we get into a relationship, oh, this is going to be great, and our partner changes, and then it's not so satisfying, so what we grab kind of disintegrated, or we change. It's not satisfying anymore. All the thrills, the infatuations. You know, you go to all these movies together and everything seems great, and then you're in a relationship, and after a while you find out, well, she didn't really like the movies, and she didn't really like the Celtics games, and you know, and everything changes again, right? So maybe talk about, you know, some kind of desires that are pretty powerful issues for most people. And I think that the two biggest ones that I'm aware of, well, I don't know, there's a lot of them. Two big ones are desire for relationships. And I think, you know, probably one of the other biggest ones is this sense of inadequacy, desire to be something more than you are. And I guess just a few weeks ago, a woman came up to me after a class and said, you know, I really want to be in a relationship with my husband, but he just can't do it. He's kind of like Anna Karenina's husband. You know, he just doesn't know how to connect with people. And so what she found herself doing is, you know, at one point sort of wanting to be able to connect, making effort, and then realization that she can't possibly do that because she's not capable of it, and then pushing away. Okay. So how do we work with that? I can talk about, from my own personal experience, about, it's been quite a while ago, maybe 10 years or longer. You know, my wife was really totally absorbed with taking care of the kids. We had some very challenging children. Maybe they're all challenging, I don't know. And just really wasn't available. And for a while, I tried to fill myself up with other things, kind of this grab and drop for feeding on something else. And it just wasn't working. So I started looking at desire itself. And this is key, whether it's emotional difficulty, inner critic, whatever. Rather than focusing on the object, what you think you should be, what you think you need, focus on the desire itself, the mental state, because that's what this craving is. It's a mental state. The mind wants something. Okay, and just to open to that state and be with it. Allow it, not to struggle with it. I mean, in a way, if you think about the end of dukkha, it's not struggling with what's happening this very moment. So if for a start, if you step back from what's happening, kind of being the observer, that already diffuses things a little bit. It's not all about me, at least. And then just be with it for a while and notice it comes to an end. Whatever the difficulty is, it's a mind state that arises, or it can be a physical experience that arises. It's there for a while and it's gone. That's our practice, no matter almost any issue. I kind of interesting in a way, I think we have all these classes on dealing with difficult energies or the inner critic or whatever, but fundamentally it's like, well, you know, we open to what's there, we step back and observe it, we don't identify with it, and we see it comes to an end. It's not personal. And, you know, I invited people when we were sitting this evening just to really look at, you know, what was happening. Is there some desire to get to some state or some aversion to something? And you know, what's there? There's a mental state that wants things to be some other way. And we can kind of see the stress in that particular mental state. There's an ease that happens from it. So my experience with my wife is what happened was I realized that, you know, it was kind of a, I'm not sure how to language it, but it was like kind of a conditioned way of being. I thought I needed this to fill myself up. And I realized that, you know, I go on retreats for 3 months, I'm perfectly happy. And so what happened was that the wanting really just dissolved. And then we could meet out of the sheer joy of being together, rather than out of wanting. And that's a relationship. When we're trying to fill ourselves up with relationships, what we try and do is control the relationship, get your partner to be the way you want them to be so that you'll feel satisfied. I like Doug Phillips. You know, I think he gives great talks, and he always talks about the fact that his wife doesn't turn the lights off. You know, and how, you know, at first he gets very frustrated with it, and you know he sort of wants her to change, and he realizes she's just like this. She's not going to turn the lights off. And so when he accepts her the way she is, then he's not struggling so much, and their relationship's better. Now that doesn't mean that they won't sit down and talk about it. You know, hopefully in some, you know, equanimous, compassionate, kind way, but at least he's kind of realistic. This is her nature. You know, my wife has a whole different mental process than me, and you know, I could sort of say, well, this is illogical, this doesn't make any sense, but, you know, that's just my view. We all have different minds, they work different ways. And to open to the possibility that, well, you know, it's just my view. That's the kind of thing we're attached to, right? You know, that's a desire to be right. And when we know we're right, we know who's wrong, right? So when we're with the desire and we open to it, and this isn't like, you know, we just do this one day and it's done, but, you know, we work with it over some time, the desire dissolves. And what's there is a freedom that the craving mind really can't understand. This is what I was told about when I was practicing early in my years, that there has, if you don't have something else, you're going to run around trying to get all these desires fulfilled. And the something else is the peace of not wanting, the peace of just being fully present in this moment. Okay. So I want to just maybe say a little bit about maybe how to work with difficult desires or energies or aversions. It's really helpful to ground yourself in the body. The mind has no ground. It's the only way it has ground is to spin. You know, it's just going to keep on going, taking views, opinions, complaining, trying to fix things. And the heart sense, this sense of this felt sense, which really gets us here, is just pushed and pulled around by praise and blame, gain and loss. So really helpful to ground yourself in the body. First of all, it helps quiet the mind down, and it actually is the way we discharge emotions. And a lot of these forces that drive us to do things, to want, are conditioned in the body. They're really, our whole history is kind of locked in the body in a way. And so by being able to come to the body and allowing it to release what's there, by being able to be with it, these patterns that we have become freed. And so when you come into the body, if there's some difficult experience, see if you can find a part of the body that feels okay. And I always joke, I do this every talk, my toes always feel okay, you know, they don't get emotional. But just find some part of the body that's okay rather than where all the pain is. And you can kind of notice where the pain is, where the discomfort is. And you can kind of be to the edge of it, but keep the attention wide enough that you can hold what's going on. And sometimes it's useful to use questions or phrases. You know, how am I relating to this moment? You know, are we pushing something away? Are we trying to get something? Trying to get rid of something? There are compassion phrases. So we're going to bring compassion to what's going on. May I care for my pain? May I care for my sorrow? That's a good one. Or equanimity phrases. May I hold this in the spaciousness of my heart? So the effort is really to try and, what happens is the mind contracts around a particular thing. And so we want to widen and soften the mind, we want to widen and soften the body, and just allow it to be there. And it takes some patience and kindness and compassion and determination to just do that. But over time, these desires dissolve. You know, maybe at first they're just dissolving in a particular sitting or particular moment, but over time they become weaker and weaker. And this, so letting go of desire isn't about not having something. It's not that we can't enjoy things. It's just that the mental quality of craving, the leaning into, with the wanting. You know, you meet somebody and you're really kind of intrigued by them, and what the mind does is it just obsesses about someone that maybe you saw for a few hours, right? That's the part that's causing all this, the stress. And just to see that, okay, the mind's doing this, that we don't identify with the thought process. So maybe I'll just say a little bit about the inner critic. Yeah, in a way, this is kind of a part of the pain body, right? If we kind of beat up on ourselves, you know, what is happening with the inner critic? Where is the inner critic? It's in the mind, right? And where's the part that's being criticized? It's in the mind too. You're not outside the mind controlling and fixing things. You've got one part of mind fighting the other part of mind. And just that realization is helpful. And then, you know, if you say, well, I'm going to get rid of this inner critic, that's another part of the mind fighting another part of the mind. So that's why the practice is really not to do anything about it. It's just to allow it to be there. I think the beauty of this, the Satipatthana Sutta, this discourse on mindfulness, is that the first three foundations of mindfulness is the Buddha says, don't do anything. Just see it. The mind's contracted, the mind's distracted. The mind has got aversion, the mind doesn't have aversion. He's just saying, bring enough attention there to see this is what's happening. Don't try and make it any particular way, because that's a form of resistance of desire. And just notice it arises. It's there for a while and it's gone. That is our practice. I mean, when I first came and Larry said, oh, well, if you're confused, just be the confusion. I didn't know what he was talking about. I want to get rid of the confusion. But that's a part of mind trying to fix another part of mind. So the practice is really just to allow things to be there, to watch them arise, abide, and pass away, and to see that they're really not personal. It's just something, these little programs running in the mind, and we just step back and watch them play out. I mean, I shouldn't say just, because sometimes they're really powerful. I mean, I've sat for weeks with adrenaline flowing through over anger or something, so it does take a real kind of settledness to be able to be with these things. And that's why a lot of practice is developing kindness and compassion and learning to develop samadhi, because we have enough stability to be with these difficult experiences. You could give a whole talk on the inner critic, how it arises and that sort of thing. But just to kind of start investigating all these ideas about what we think we should be. Where do they come from? Even a kind and compassionate person. I mean, there's even a danger in cultivating kindness and compassion if you think you should be kind and compassionate all the time, because you are what you are. Okay? But, you can see, if you see that kindness and compassion leads to a sense of freedom and ease, that you're acting from a place of wisdom, then that's skillful. But if you're acting from a place of I should be, it's not skillful. So I want to read a little quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who more was in the Advaita tradition, and I guess he died probably in the 60s or 70s. A fair number of Western teachers practiced with him. And Jack Engler actually gave a talk on desire about a month ago. And I was curious what he'd say, and he actually quoted Nisargadatta Maharaj, and he said, the quote was, the problem is not desire, the problem is our desires are not great enough. So what he was pointing to is that we're trying to find little sense experiences, you know, fill up with relationships, but there's something really greater than that. The greater is to awaken. Okay. So this is another quote by Nisargadatta Maharaj, and I think it's a good quote to take into your daily life and investigation. Think clearly and deeply. Go into the structure of your desires and their ramifications. They are the most important part of your mental and emotional makeup and powerfully affect your actions. So remember, you cannot abandon what you do not know. To go beyond yourself, you must know yourself. So I think really if we really make an intention to see what pushes and pulls us around, what we're trying to get, what we're trying to get rid of, and really investigate them rather than act from them. That's the path to freedom. That's the path to really going beyond yourself in the Nisargadatta Maharaj's language. And to go beyond yourself, to go beyond this sense of a me who's separate from experience is what the teacher was referring to when he told me that it's hard to let go of desires if you don't have anything else. To see through this limited self, this fabrication of the mind that needs all these things, and it needs all these things because it's not real. It's a bunch of thought processes playing out, and we believe them. I think in the elders group a month ago or so, someone said, you know, they had taken a class with Narayan, and some of the wisdom that came up was, don't believe your thoughts. Another piece was, cling to absolutely nothing. And clinging is actually what is a strong form of craving, trying to hold on to something when everything's changing. It doesn't work. So I'm going to close with a little discourse which points to the part that I started this talk off with, that all phenomena is rooted in desire, that everything we see, think, experience comes from desire. And it also points to the freedom that's available when we don't act from a place of a desire. And I guess I'll use the word craving now, because this discourse talks about craving. For one who clings, which clinging again is the strong form of craving, you sort of want something and then you grab onto it, that's clinging. Motion exists. So for one who clings, motion exists. But for one who clings not, there is no motion. And you can kind of think about this motion as kind of running here, running there, trying to get satisfaction. Where no motion is, there is stillness. And stillness is the closest word I know to, I think, what people would describe an awakening experience as like. Where stillness is, there is no craving. So no clinging, there's stillness. Where there's stillness, there's no craving. Where no craving is, there is neither coming nor going. And neither coming or going refers to birth and death. And if you kind of think about this from a Western perspective, the sense of identity gets created over and over again. You know, you want a piece of chocolate cake, and you are the person who wants the piece of chocolate cake. And you have the second piece of chocolate cake, and you're the person who's sick. So, you know, you keep forming these identities out of your desires. Okay? So this birth and death is this constant creating of a sense of self from desire. Everything, all desires create your, define what you are, right? Where there's neither coming nor going is, there's neither arising nor passing away. So the Buddha's teaching is that all conditioned things are impermanent. Conditioned things are things that are fabricated by the, well, not just by the mind, but things that are put together. And we're not putting anything together. There's neither arising or passing away. So there's no time. time is created by trying to get somewhere or trying to get rid of something, right? There's an idea we're here now, and there's a thought that occurs now that now is not good enough, and I'll be happy when I get to some future now. We create this sense of time. We create this sense of time where we worry about what we're going to be like in the future, which creates all kinds of anxiety and fear. Right? So it's saying when there's no craving, there's no arising or passing away. I'm talking experientially here, not what the ultimate reality is. I don't know if we'll ever know what ultimate reality is. But experientially, there's just this sense of stillness, of nothing arising and passing away, of nothing coming and going. That's what's there when we let go of craving. And it doesn't have to be some big breakthrough where you're forever free. You can just look for moments when you're just here, just fully present. And this fully present is not just a mental experience. It's the whole mind, body, heart. It's a sense of here-ness. Someone asked Ajahn Sucitto last week what he meant by here-ness, and he had a nice little metaphor. He said, you know, it's like riding a wave, and you're always on the right spot of the wave. You're so present with everything that's going on. You have to be to stay on that wave. And there's no sense of time, even though the wave's moving, you're moving, but you're so present, there's no kind of remembering the past or looking into the future. You're just fully embodied in this very moment. So where there's neither arising nor passing away, there is neither this world nor that world nor a world in between. So what is that referring to? This world is the sense door, seeing, hearing, knowing. That world is the object, the sense door context. And nor a state in between is the consciousness, the knowing. So what it's saying is this whole sense of subject, object, and knowing falls away. The sense of someone outside the experience falls away. There isn't even a sense of experience. When one's in stillness and comes out of it, you can't really describe it. That's probably why the Buddha never said a whole lot about what awakening was. He said what it wasn't. You know, craving, greed, hatred, and delusion. It wasn't that. But it didn't, you know, there's sort of some pointers to what it was. But there's no subject, object, or knower. So there's no one having experience. You are boundless. I mean, there isn't really you. So this verily is the end of suffering. The end of craving is the end of suffering. Another line I really like, and I'll close with, is Nisargadatta Maharaj once said, wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between the two, my life flows. And when he says he's nothing, he doesn't mean that he's a void. He's saying there's no core, there's no center. That's the notion of emptiness that in the Indian philosophy is there's just no core. Okay? So maybe we can come down to earth in the discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.